Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. It is another exciting night to be on Homefront. I know that many of you have been watching, wondering what is happening in the St. Louis area. And so we bring to you some experts tonight who can sort it out. So fasten your seatbelts. It started with the Ferguson police, and then the Missouri governor called in the State Highway Patrol. Now there's an effort to get the United Nations involved. So with Al Sharpton and the Black Panthers, along with all the others from out of state trying to interfere with our community, it's hard to maintain our stability. So now we have the police arresting elected officials and members of the media who are present, ordering them to disperse. If they don't go away, then they get the tear gas just like everyone else. So who is in the right and what is the right? So tonight we have Dan Benson. He's a retired police officer from the city of Bridgeton and a constitutional scholar, I might add. So welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you for inviting me on your show. I'm really excited about the fact we had an opportunity to talk.
Yeah, well, let me recap the events for the listeners who may not have been watching the news. Of course, I don't know how you can avoid it. People are almost sick and tired of the story by now, but yet it continues going. It's like a saga. So we had a young man who had a problem with the police officer, ended up getting shot. These facts we agree on. But the rest are wild variations going around of what really happened next. And through all these altercations, we have to make sense out of what does that mean to us. Obviously, we don't live in St. Louis County, but you having been a police officer in St. Louis County might be in a good position to comment on what is this. I don't think it's about the young man anymore. I think they're trying to make a story about racism, municipal government, ineptness, heavy-handedness. How do you define the story for yourself?
Well, the story is really defined about the history of that part of the community, the Flores and Ferguson area. You know, 25, 30 years ago, Flores and Ferguson were primarily white communities, about 70, 75% white, 15, 18, 20% black. And as time went on, and I believe, as some black leaders have said, that the Great Society that was started by Johnson in the 60s, as it expanded, really made the black community dependent on government, broke up the families, really had a lot of negative impacts on the black community. And crime started to expand out of the city into those neighboring neighborhoods, and there was what was commonly called white flight. And out of that, 20 years of that, there has grown an atmosphere of distrust by the black majority population toward the administration and the police department, which are still primarily white. Is there racism involved? Absolutely. Is there racism on both sides? Yes, it is. Do most officers that I know really try to do a good job and be as fair and equal-handed as they can? Yes. But the reality is and you know, I've been a Christian since I was in the Marine Corps. I came to Christ when I was 27 years old and was in the Marine Corps as an officer. And I've been a Christian for almost 40 years. And the reality is, it was a struggle for me not to become jaded over a period of time in dealing with the crime that we had to deal with. And so it is a struggle. And it's something that you have to really, really, it's a spiritual battle, because the flesh and our own cultural upbringing, we see the world through our own eyes. And that's exactly what's happening. We're having a white culture and community that is not blending. And we have a black culture and community that's not blending. And there has been confrontation and conflict. And yeah, have things have been done that shouldn't have been done? Absolutely. You know, the old thing about, the crime of driving while black. Has that happened? Yes, it has. Is it commonplace? No. But has it happened? Yes. And when those few incidents happens, that becomes the banner and stereotyping the other side. The white side stereotypes the black and the black side stereotypes the other side. And that's typically what's happening here is the real challenge is trying to get beyond the stereotypes, trying to get beyond these differences, trying to get people to heal together and come together and try to work together and break down those walls that have been built up for such a long period of time. And unfortunately, as these events have carried out, there are agitators. There are people who are taking advantage of this situation to create, instead of breaking down the walls, to actually make things worse. And that's what I think we're really seeing here. Because it's kind of interesting. I was talking to someone that I know that is still very well connected with the churches in Ferguson and Florissant area. And every night since this incident has begun, the churches have been packed. People are praying for peace. People are praying for healing. People are praying for the agitators to go away. People are praying for the community to come together. And no matter how the outcome of this is that this be an opportunity for healing. Where on the other side is people are seeing this as an opportunity to create more division. So really what you're really seeing is that's exactly what's going on. And this is an unfortunate incident. It's difficult right now to really comment on exactly what happened because we don't know all the details. But I believe this is what is happening. And I think it's a real indicative of the spiritual breakdown of our society and our culture. And with this chaos, the government has taken the opportunity to come in and step in and try to bring order. And the tough thing is, how much is enough and how much is too much? And that's the real challenge.
Right. Well, I went through, when I was in municipal government, I was in the city of O'Fallon on the board of aldermen, and we had a citizens police academy. And what I did at that time is I learned that that's the number one job of the police officers to maintain control. And of course, just to give you a little history lesson, that's why we have civil government, because people wanted to be protected. And it is scary when you think about what if the bad guys hurt us. So here's, we've got William Grigg with us. He is a former correspondent, researcher, and senior editor for the New American Magazine. Will, I'm so honored to have you here tonight. Obviously, you're looking at it from a distance, but the same story is true. The principles of where do we expect protection to lead us and how do we keep ourselves safe? Those are the questions. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on what's going on in Ferguson. I know you can't comment on all the details, but in a big picture sense, is this happening all over the country?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate your kindness and the invitation to your program, and I am heartbroken over what's happening in Missouri, and I do think that it represents sort of a climacteric, if you will. I think that we're seeing this year the bursting of what you might call the homeland security bubble, in the sense that I think a lot of misunderstandings and illusions are being clarified or dispelled. Because most people have purchased, they've bought into the idea that we can have something akin to comprehensive safety and security in exchange for authorizing the people who are supposedly our servants to have plenary control over us. And I don't think that you're going to find necessarily across the country circumstances that replicate the mix of racial antagonisms and municipal problems that characterize Ferguson. But when it comes to the question of overreach by local, geographically local, but federalized law enforcement agencies, I think the aftermath of what happened in the shooting is a very good illustration of exactly what resides beneath the veneer of our society right now. That's the skull beneath the skin, if you will. And over the last week or so, you've had, of course, the protests, and the protests occurred because there was a rupture in the body politic. And into that rupture, of course, you've had an opportunistic infection of people who are professional revolutionaries and people like Al Sharpton and his contemptible ilk who work both sides of the equation. Here's somebody who's a street-level rabble-rouser. At the same time, he's a federally subsidized informant for the FBI. The fellow who styles himself the head of what's called the New Black Panther Party has filled a similar role. They have invaded, in the form of pathogens, a wounded community, and they're doing their level best, and it's a considerable effort on their part to ensure that civility and understanding don't break out. And so you have people who most likely have arrived in Ferguson from outside who are trained in street-level revolution, who are attacking property in that town, thereby preventing normalcy from descending again. And at the same time, you have these militarized, federalized law enforcement agencies who are likewise attacking private property and not moving to protect private property. Because that's not the job of law enforcement. That's one thing that people have tardily come to understand. Law enforcement, as distinct from the role of peace officers, law enforcement represents the enforcement of the will of the political class. Police are hired by the political class in order to defend their interests against those of us who are part of the productive sector of society. They don't protect persons and property because they're the enforcement arm of those who prey upon property rights through taxation and regulation. And this is particularly the case in Ferguson. If you take a look at the recent report that was released, I think just within the last day, by Arch City Defenders there in the St. Louis area, it's pretty clear that the municipal courts are being used as a huge engine of revenue for the municipal government. And that's one of the reasons why people are so furious. The black residents of Ferguson, for the most part, are furious. And nearly three-quarters, they're two-thirds of the population in any case of that city. Because if you take a look at the statistics for traffic stops and citations, it's pretty clear that there has been a systematic pattern and practice of conducting these traffic stops and inflicting these violations and using this as a source of revenue. And when people are sucked into that system, it has a way of blighting their prospects for employment and for education and things of that sort. That is something that is not necessarily part of the story of the Michael Brown shooting, but it's the context in which you have to place the sort of inchoate frustrations of the people living in Ferguson right now. Now, the police are integral to this system of revenue farming, and that's the case pretty much everywhere in the country. And so if we actually had a system based upon the protection of persons and property, that would sort of comport with what the Bible says in Romans chapter 13 about people wielding the sword in defense of the innocent against predators. That's the sort of thing that we should have, but we don't have that system right now. And so I hope that people would take away an understanding here that it's not incidental to the nature of contemporary law enforcement that you would have the riot police who are confronting protesters of various kinds, some of them peaceful, some of them, of course, outside agitators, telling shop owners who are facing the destruction of their property and the destruction of their livelihood that they do not have the task of coming to their protection, so those property owners have to go out and get firearms and protect their own property. That's how things actually work in the larger sense. That's true in Ferguson and elsewhere, where there's an upheaval, a type of insurrection, where there's tumult. The first task of law enforcement, as you pointed out, is to control the people. It's not to protect their property. And unfortunately, I don't think that's reconcilable with the principles of a constitutional republic or with the larger, more important biblical principles of how society is supposed to be structured.
Okay, well, that saddens me because I own a retail business, and it sounds like you're saying that the police officers don't bear any responsibility for keeping the peace when it comes to my property. So then why do I pay taxes? And Dan, you were a police officer. Tell me, from your perspective, I don't get that at all, because that is what we have come to expect. So is that right or wrong?
Yeah, the reality is that the problem with politics is politics. And government and the institutions of government are there, unfortunately, to protect the interests of those political interests. And that goes with the military, goes with Congress, it goes with the courts. It has become the interest of And the police departments are functioning as the interest of what is in the best interest of the city and not the citizen. We are instruments of government. And the reality is we've had a history of this. In just doing some research just for this, for the radio program, one of the books I ran across is, you know, we talk about the Posse Comitatus Act that was instituted in 1878 because of, you know, like Shays Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion, where they were put down by soldiers on two rebellions. But it's interesting, a guy named Sweeney put together a handbook of the American military history. And since 1878 to 1994, he documents 114 incidences where the United States government used the United States military to quell civilian unrest, civil uprisings, and protests. And the reality is the Posse Comitatus Act has been one of the most ignored statutes that have been instituted by the federal government in our history. And the reality is why did they ignore it? Why has it been overcome? And if you look at these 114 incidences, a lot of it has to do with interests of big business and government for their own purposes and their own agenda, at sacrificing, like a lot of situations, like one incident where there were veterans who were losing benefits at the Great Depression, and they had a big sit-in, and the United States military came in and broke these guys up, and people were shot by our own military. So, I mean, that's just an example. And this is just a pattern that has been developing even from the very beginning of our nation. It's amazing. And so this is not an unusual event. This is the problem is now we're getting the UN involved. For example, when the water was shut off, I guess it was in Detroit, they're calling in the UN. Now they're saying it's a right for people to have water. And now the UN is sending a delegation here to look at civil rights violations here in the United States. Again, what we're losing here is we're losing our sense of sovereignty. We're losing our sense of a republic. We're losing our sense of individual rights and freedoms, the private property, the freedom of the individual. And reality is government has become a tool of the corporations, a tool of big business and big banking, and they are going to do their bidding and what is in their best interest. And the reality is that most of us as people, individuals, communities, are going to be manipulated into a situation that's going to work out for their benefit. And Ferguson is a classic example of that, where both sides are being agitated for the very purposes of furthering their agenda.
Well, the first night that this all started with the rioting, we thought, well, that's one night. And here we are. What is it going to take to make it stop?
Well, the reality is it will wind itself down until there's another incident. Everything has a cycle to it. They've identified the agitators, which probably took, what they did last night is what they should have done in the beginning. Is not with that heavy, I'm really dismayed, just the tremendous amount of weapons that everyone had. Now, granted, there has to be police lines and there has to be control of, and there, because there are agitators there. But the idea, when I was in Japan for 2 years, I studied international government and politics in Japan, and I actually watched the Japanese police deal with riots, and they had. And then back in those days, they were the Japanese leftists were rioting against the Japanese government and because they were allowing Americans to have nuclear weapons on Okinawa. And what was interesting was the Japanese government initially never really would directly confront. They would draw lines and they would limit the demonstrations. But when it got ruly, they would simply identify who the rabble rousers were. And they would isolate the rabble rousers, go out, attack, get the rabble rousers, arrest them, withdraw, and over at a short period of time, it would be over. And so it was kind of like capture the flag kind of tactics. But they were very efficient, very brief. When it got out of hand, yeah, they did tear. I remember one incident when I was living in my apartment, not far from the university where I was staying in Tokyo. Once they got rid of all the leaders, they re-rallied down in a park, which was part of the old Olympic complex, and they started to reorganize again. And they just simply went after the leaders, and they did tear gas it. But I'll tell you what, it was over in a day, and there were minimal arrests, there were minimal injuries, and it was over. It just really seemed like initially there wasn't a lot of clear thought or vision or understanding on how to deal with this. The Japanese had a very good, clear vision on how to deal with things. And they did it efficiently and as minimally as possible. But the reality is here is there is just a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty. And what happens, you have overreaction, then underreaction, then overreaction, and it's just out of control. And it's just sad to see that we're just not equipped to be able to have a balanced response and good tactical strategies to identify the rabble-rousers, eliminate them. And if we could do that quickly and efficiently, this would have died down a whole lot sooner. Now, granted, I can't guarantee, you know, can we prevent this from happening? No, you can't. But when these things do happen, when they come, we are going to have to respond to it. But do we need to respond with all that mass weaponry, pointing guns at everybody? Where in reality, I remember when I was started as a cop 25 years ago. When we had incidences, yeah, we had riot helmets and gear. We didn't bring all these weapons. I mean, when I started out, I was in a patrol car, and I had a 357 Magnum. With 18 rounds of ammo. When I retired last year, I have a Glock, and I had over 50 rounds of ammo for that. A shotgun mounted in the car with at least a box of 20 rounds of ammo for that. And an assault rifle with at least 60 rounds of ammo for that. And the reality is why are we... Why are we doing this? Why do the police seem to be need to be that heavily armed? What are we preparing for? Do we know that something's coming? Or is this the groundwork for something that's in the near future? Do they know that they're planning and laying the groundwork for something bigger that is coming? The question is this the groundwork for something bigger and something more ominous? Where we may need even more help than the police than they can handle themselves.
Will, do you think there's a push to train us to get used to martial law? Or do you think that all this is helping to desensitize us? I remember when the Tea Party movement was trying to gain steam and they met with several defeats. And I asked a friend of mine, what is it going to take to wake people up? And the answer was tanks in the streets. And we just saw tanks in the streets.
And then Boston happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Boston happened where you had a full-blown military response while they were searching for the bombers during the marathon. And they were being applauded, these people who were kitted out in military gear and in armored vehicles and ordering people out of their homes and generally clamping down sort of a free-flowing martial law type of an environment wherever they went. They were cheered in the streets of Boston, which is the same place where he had the Boston riot, which is called the Boston Massacre of 1770, the cradle of liberty, and, of course, the mother to inveterate anti-government radicalism, which I use as a commendation, not as a denigration in talking about the history of that town. That was, if you will, something of a beta test for something that's coming. And I think we're seeing the second beta test in Ferguson. And what's happening in Ferguson, I feel, is that you're going to find a type of free propagating radicalism that's going to find a seam, like a coal seam, in sort of the subterranean stratum of our society, and it's going to repropagate itself elsewhere in other urban areas throughout the country. I'm convinced that's going to happen. That'll be a horrible thing. I wanted to address one thing that Dan brought up that I think is very worth embellishing a little bit, and that has to do with the role of the United Nations in all of this. Most of what he's described, I contend. I've not served in law enforcement. I've spent a lot of time in the company of law enforcement. I studied to become a police detective at one time. And back in 1997, when I was with the New American, I actually went out and got a certificate in counterterrorism at the University of Illinois, Chicago, as part of my research into what was going on, got a lot of law enforcement contacts, intelligence contacts, and compared notes with them. Most of them were people of my vintage. I'm 51 right now, and at the time I was in my 30s. And there's been a generational change, and I think it started with the declaration of the war on drugs in 1971 by the Nixon administration, and then it escalated on several occasions after that. You had the systematic violation of the posse comitatus begin in the 1980s under Reagan and Bush, interestingly enough. Ronald Reagan, the great conservative hero, and George H.W. Bush, the former head of the CIA, meaning the world's chief drug kingpin in my estimation. But they started setting up liaisons with Joint Task Force 6 and some of these other task forces where you had domestic law enforcement, albeit federal law enforcement, starting to commingle with the military in drug interdiction operations. And out of that, about 10 years later, this would be 1995, you had the Law Enforcement Support Organization, or LESO. That's where the 1033 program comes out, where suddenly every jurisdiction in the country has a law enforcement department, a local police force that's got all this battlefield-grade armor and armored vehicles. But this is all in the context of the war on drugs, which actually began in 1961 with the United Nations Initiative, the single statute on narcotic drugs. And that's where asset forfeiture comes in. In 1988, there was a United Nations agreement on asset forfeiture that is, I think, probably the fountainhead of all these seizure operations where police are literally conducting highway robbery in the name of the war on drugs and confiscating property, although criminal charges are often never filed. And I think that so you're dealing here with the radiating consequences of our improvident involvement in the United Nations having an impact on changing the law enforcement culture to where people who've come into police work since about 1993 and 1995 don't know what it was like before that cultural change. So you've got the United Nations on the one hand being used by people, I believe, in our government to change the culture of the federal government, the culture of law enforcement. And then you have this type of a crisis erupt in Ferguson. You have United Nations observers on the ground castigating the United States government for not keeping our obligations, our international obligations under United Nations human rights provisions, as if those really mean anything. But you have really sort of a dialectical closed loop here. You know, the solution, the problem, the crisis was propagated with the help of the United Nations, which is now collaborating and helping supposedly to create a solution. And that solution is going to involve more centralization of power, probably more militarization of law enforcement in order to bring about a cultural change that they desire. And so I think they're using Ferguson as something of a test laboratory in order to develop a model that they're going to export experts throughout the United States.
You know, when Dan Benz...
I want to add to that, too. Most people don't realize that all department policies, rules, regulations, and procedures are now internationally certified. And what that means through CALEA or the Police Chief Association, and what that means is that a police officer from another NATO or European UN police agency could come in, and if he speaks English and can read English, will completely understand, know, and be able to familiarize himself very quickly with rules, regulations, and policies and procedures because they're universal. And that is a really troubling thing. Why do I, as a police department in the middle of the United States, in a small suburban town in the middle of the country, have to have my rules, policies, and regulations be standardized under international standards? So you understand here just the fact that our rules and policy now are mandated by the federal government to become consistent with international law. So we're headed toward that. The department that I worked with resisted that. And then one day we had federal agents come in and saying, if you don't do this, we'll decertify you. So we had to do it. And we tried to fight it. But in order for us to exist, we were forced to do this. I remember, do you remember, Cynthia, a couple years ago, when the National Guard was doing training with armored personnel carriers in the North County area or in the North City area in the sub, and it was made the news. And one of the interesting things was, is that I remember reading the news reporter asked the U.S. Army, you know, why are you guys doing this? And they said, well, there's nothing to see here, just standardized training. We're training our drivers. And at the end of the news program, they interviewed three citizens, three people from North City, which is, you know, basically the poorest part of town. And the three interviews that they had was, again, here's the media working the agenda. Boy, you know, it was really nice to see the U.S. military and armored personnel carrier on the streets. You know, maybe we need more of that. With all the crime and the shootings going on here, maybe we do need the U.S. military here to help bring peace and security to this part of our community. So the whole idea here, you are right, this is conditioning, this is getting things just changing the mindset to making this okay. And you know, I have to go back to the idea, you know, peace and safety. You know, if you can't have, you know, if you want peace and safety, if you want total fairness, then you're not going to have freedom. Part of we live in a fallen world. We have fallen people. And part of the fact is that we are willing to deal and hopefully deal with conflict and the disagreements in a civilized manner, as we have tried to set up as we establish this nation, not using violence and not using conflict. And the reality is it takes an educated and a moral people for this to work. And what's happened through Agenda 21, it's what's happened through the destruction of our economy and the dollar, and the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, this is all being dismantled. And so this whole foundation is being torn apart to where it can't survive. And so in this vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum, they're going to come in with this system. And that's exactly what's going on.
Well, I know that when I was early in municipal government, the police officers used to deliver our packets, and they knew we had 100 police officers, but all of them knew our names. They knew where we lived. They knew what we were all about, and there was a congeniality we could expect. Now, you know, 16 years later, I'm no longer in government anymore. I was in the legislature for 8 years after that, and they seemed to know me back then too, and they were nice to me. Now that I'm getting a chance to see what it feels like on the other side, the tone is very different. I've had one police officer came to my house 10 minutes after I came home from a meeting, and he said, somebody called him and said they thought I was swerving. I had another police officer where I called him to come to my house because I had a dispute, and he didn't know who I was. So he asked to see my driver's license, even though I'm a business owner standing in my business. So I went to go get my purse, and he yelled at me, "What are you doing?" And I said, "You told me to go get my ID. Just trying to get it for you." And he acted shocked, and he said, "Well, you don't go anywhere unless I tell you you can leave."
Oh, boy.
And I'm like, what is this? I don't recognize these people. What happened to them being nice to us? And I'm the one who called them, for goodness sake. They are a public servant to the public. And I don't fully understand these attitudes, and I'm disappointed because there does seem to be a growing distance between the attitude of to protect and serve and what we have today, where they would treat a nice lady in the community like I'm going to, what did he think I was going to do, go get a gun or something?
Well, Cynthia, I spend a great deal of time criticizing police officers and other officials who were involved in the abuse of power and committing what I consider to be criminal aggression. I want to spend just a little bit of time here commending the sheriff here in Payette County, Idaho. I had about an hour and a half, two-hour-long interview with him about a year or so ago. And when I walked into the office of Sheriff Huff here, he's somebody who calls himself a constitutional sheriff and takes that role seriously. we have some disagreements about some important things, not the least of which is the war on drugs, but he's somebody I consider reasonable. I walked into the company of a friend of mine who's the former son of the local prosecutor. That's how I got an appointment with the sheriff. And he was upset because he had been compelled by an arbitration board to continue providing benefits to a sheriff, to a deputy he had fired, because the deputy had been involved in an avoidable car accident that took the life of an innocent person. He said, that deputy not only should have been fired, he told me, Sheriff Tuff told me, he should have been prosecuted. But he wasn't permitted to do this because of the arbitration agreement that was imposed on his office. He wasn't at all happy with that. And I immediately thought, this is somebody I'm probably going to like. And in the course of our conversation, one of the sources of frustration he expressed to me was the fact that he'll get these deputies out of the Post Academy, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Academy in Meridian, Idaho. And most of them come out of the military. And he says, I have to defugify these guys. That's the expression he used. I have to defugify them because they come out of Post Academy filled to the brim with the notion that they are not peace officers serving the public, but that they are part of an army of occupation on a 360-degree battlefront, and that they have to look upon the public as this undifferentiated mass of potential menace and a threat to officer safety, and they define their role in terms of force protection and officer safety. And in every encounter they have with the public, they're looking upon that member of the public as a potential threat, even somebody who is a nice woman who's got experience in municipal government and the state legislature. They view us as a threat to their safety, and they consider their highest priority to be officer safety. And Sheriff Huff, who on one occasion defused a SWAT standoff by taking off his gun and walking up to the front door and knocking on the door and talking to the besieged homeowner who is the subject of a domestic violence call, he said, I teach my deputies that if they're going to be wearing my uniform and serving in my department, they're going to have to accept certain risks. They don't have to be law enforcement officers. They don't have to be deputy sheriffs. But if they're going to be deputy sheriffs, they're going to understand that part of their job entails absorbing risks to protect the public they're going to be serving. Now, that's a dying ethic, unfortunately. And I think that it has to do, once again, with this forced reprogramming of people who enter this profession that is an outgrowth of a dramatic and dire escalation on the part of the government ruling us in terms of expanding its influence in our lives and expanding its claimed authority and jurisdiction over us. I mean, they have been, for the last couple of generations, very much since 1993, 1994, with the Clinton-era omnibus crime bill, certainly, they've been recruiting people into what is increasingly a federalized body of police officers, and they have been indoctrinating them to see the public as a threat. And that's one of the reasons why you see such a ready resort to overwhelming force in places like Ferguson. There's a veteran of the 82nd Airborne I'm familiar with who served overseas in an active war zone. And the first couple of nights, as the images rolled out of Ferguson, he said, good grief, we didn't roll that heavy in an actual war zone. And that says a lot about the attitudes that have been enculturated into contemporary law enforcement, unfortunately.
Do you think that the militarization escalated things, or how would you have handled it if they'd made you the chief of police down there?
Well, the reality is, number one, the first thing I would have done is gotten a hold of the community leaders, which they did days later, and really created a partnership to have these guys as the front line and to deal with, to help deal with people and control and to work in coordination with them. We know that we're going to be people have a right to protest. People have a right to walk in the street. People have a right to do all these things. Reality is the thing is there, we need to be there to keep the peace. And to watch, and not to control, but to simply watch and keep an eyes out, and to have a presence there. But and then to have people, you know, I would even have ununiformed, undercover agents walking through the crowd, identifying the rabble rousers, and then through being able to identify the rabble rousers, the people who are trying to incite violence. Isolate these individuals and get them out of there. And the reality is you get rid of the agitation, you're going to have a peaceful demonstration. And so the heavy-handedness is just a mindset. Oh, you know, everything that was just said was just absolutely, totally, and completely right on. And not only is it a mindset, but the training is that every police department in the St. Louis area
from the city, county, and all the municipalities, St. Charles City, St. Charles County, St. Peter's, O'Fallon. They've had what is called MACTAC training. And it's multiple active shooter counter-terrorism course. And basically, it is the tactics that have been developed through the Iraqi and Afghan wars, where you develop a four-man team, and if you have what is considered a potential threat, an armed potential threat, you go in, you don't say, freeze, police, you don't announce yourself, you go in, you find the shooter, you find the man with a gun, and you kill him. Totally military tactics.
Yeah.
And it's not police tactics anymore. It's totally military. And what you're finding, too, is like the National Guard now is being trained in police tactics, in using pepper spray, using mass arrests, how to create the chain of going in, identifying, arresting large numbers of individuals, passing them back through the line, getting them with the flex cuffs on, and then putting them in the personnel carriers and transporting them to detention centers, which is what they were practicing a year and a half ago on the streets of North St. Louis with the armored personnel carriers with the National Guard. So we're learning military tactics, and the military is learning police tactics. So we're preparing to work together. And the reality is when I took the training, and when I took this training, that was one of the major decisions. It's time for me to get out. This is over.
Yeah.
And the reality is, and I'm going to give you the quote that we were told in the classroom. A day is coming that you are going, and this is that, Matt, you're going to have multiple shooters at one time and every day. You won't be able to use the attack team. You won't be able to use SWAT because we're going to be busy. Each municipality is going to have multiple shooters on a day, almost daily basis. You got to guys learn this tactics. You're going to have to depend on each other because you're going to be on your own. And it's going to be daily, and it's going to be crazy. And they said it is coming, and you better get ready. This is what they're instilling in all the police departments all over the place. So there's this apprehension. Is this the trigger event? Is this where it's all going to go to hell? And that's where you're getting this attitude. This has been instilled in the training. And when I saw and I heard this and I realized what was going on, I said, I'm done. I can't be a part of this anymore. And so this is all being laid down. And part of my research and my expertise in constitutionalism and economics, my personal opinion is, and from my own I have my own contacts in the banking system. The banks have been told and are actually making active preparations to prepare for what the government and the Fed and the Treasury Department have told the banks, that we are going to default, that the dollar is going to be crashed, and we're going to default on our bonds. And there'll be life on the other side, but there'll be a transition period. And what we're anticipating is during that transition period, there will be chaos. And this is what they're preparing for. This is being deliberately set up, deliberately prepared. So this will be the excuse, whatever that trigger event is that causes this to happen. This is what they're preparing for. This is what they're setting it up for. And could you imagine a Ferguson or a Boston in all 50 states, in every major city, times five? That's the frightening thing that may end up happening. And the reality is they're deliberately doing this. There are foreign troops here. They are being trained in the same tactics on civil unrest control as the National Guard is being trained. And the reality is my concern is that they're already laying the groundwork, calling the UN in like they did in Boston for the water. And they're calling the UN here in Ferguson. When everything else fails, we need outside help. And when that happens, Katie, bar the door, because then it truly is all over. And that's my real concern. That's my biggest fear. That's where I think this is headed.
Well, Dan, do you think with a good network of constitutional sheriffs, we can have more constitutional behavior out of our law enforcement departments?
Unfortunately, Cynthia, and I think I would consider that a minority. An unfortunate minority. It really is, Cynthia. It really is. And you know, I was on a department of about 57 people. I would say morally, biblically, ethical conduct, about 10%, 15. I could tell you horror stories that I won't take the time to now, of the things that I had to deal with on a daily basis, the corruption, just unbelievable. Just you think the corruption is just as bad at the municipal level as it is with the federal government. There is no difference. Jesus said the love of money is the root of all evil. And the reality is why is money so powerful? Because it has power. Money walks, money talks and poverty walks. And the reality is where you have money, you have power, we have power and money. So what Jesus really could have said is the love of power is the root of all evil. And I think he's essentially saying the same thing. And the reality is the power, what was the English philosopher said, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That basically is saying the same thing. And that is what's happening. And unfortunately, the number of people who get it is so few.
Will, what are you doing to help change the course?
Well, I think what I'm doing is a role akin to that of the prophet Jeremiah, if I could be so bold as to compare myself to somebody who was a vessel of the divine word. And that I'm simply trying to tell the truth as I'm given wisdom to understand it and spending a lot of time crying my eyes. But one of the things that I have done in terms of our own personal family preparations is that I have found a place to live that is outside of a major municipal area and that is conceivably a self-sustaining little economic biome. And I think that that's a wise thing to do if you have the opportunity. I know there are places in Missouri that meet that description. But one of the things that Dan said that is a scenario that haunts my dreams is the question of what will happen when and not if you have a major hiccup in the financial system. And we've seen little premonitory tremors of that happening. About a year ago, there were a couple of disruptions of the EBT system. And the EBT system, of course, is the SNAP or food stamp program. And these are, of course, credits that are uploaded to a debit card. And they become active every first of every month. So if you go to the local Walmart Supercenter here in the Treasure Valley, at shortly before midnight, before the first day of the month, if you're there for the clock to strike midnight, you'll see that people will surge into the Walmart Supercenter because their EBT cards just loaded up. And we have a huge metastasizing population of food stamp recipients here, particularly under Obama over the last several years. And of course, this is not something that's new. This has been growing for decades, but it went parabolic under Obama. And there are huge clusters of people, huge clusters, demographic clusters, where people are very dependent on their EBT cards. And if there's a disruption, given the fact that these people are used to at the minute or the last moment acquisition of funding, they live paycheck to paycheck or EBT card upload to EBT card upload, and they have a very high time preference. They don't save, and they're not provident in husbanding what funds they have. If you have a disruption that lasts longer than, say, 48 or 72 hours, then you're going to see a huge and roiling mass of violent frustration erupt in the hearts of many of these large urban areas that have already been reduced correct to tinderboxes because of the economic collapse. We mentioned Detroit earlier and the water situation and UN intervention to deal with that moonscape of an economy. That's something I've been watching now for 10 or 12 years. I had a conversation back in 2006 with a friend of mine. I said before the end of the decade, we're going to see grass growing in the streets of Detroit. Well, there's grass growing in the streets of Detroit right now. One of the ironically encouraging things is that as that horrible municipal government has been taken into receivership and retracted, you have little projects in self-directed entrepreneurial capitalism springing up with respect to such things as taxi service and the food economy. People are eschewing some of the larger big box retailers and grocery marts, and they're growing their own foods in little microeconomic settings of that sort. You have private security being pioneered by risk management and a couple of other these private security companies that liaise with the good and conscientious people in local law enforcement to provide defensive, de-escalation-oriented protection of persons and property. And so there are some encouraging experiments that are sort of pullulating there in Detroit after this horrible municipal government has collapsed. But I think that you can take a look at that as a potential model for what is on the other side of the scenario that Dan described.
Yes.
You can take a look at Ferguson as a microcosm of what the other side is trying to bring about. They really do want to ignite a continent-spanning conflagration here as a cleansing fire, so that out of the ashes they can rebuild a society closer to their heart's desire. And that's not something I want to be a part of, and that's one of the reasons I got my family out to Idaho back in 2005. That's something I'm doing because that's my primary responsibility as a father and as a husband. But in terms of what we can do nationally, I'm of the opinion that the most healthy thing we could have would be to break up the mass of our unitary state. I don't see any reason why people who love America shouldn't love America so much that we would like to see many of them rather than just one here on the same continent spending landmass. I don't think that our current political or economic model is sustainable. Of course, they're the same thing. We're living in corporatism. You know, it's big money and big business and huge overarching militarized political power. And I think it would be a good thing if we started seeing little projects in state or regional self-government where we would try to make the federal government irrelevant, let alone what the United Nations is trying to do. I mean, good grief, if the United States quit supporting the United Nations, it would collapse under the weight of its own absurdity in a minute.
Yep.
And that would be a wonderful thing to behold as well.
Yes.
Now, you brought up... go ahead, Dan.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Cynthia. I'm
well,
sorry.
You brought up family. I wanted to say family. I want to bring that up because you talked earlier about the societal change. And when I read the story of the young man in Ferguson, the first thing I noticed in the article is his mother and his father, and he have different last names. Now, when you see that, what does that tell you? And in the saddest part is it was no surprise. We're watching when we see boys growing up with no father in the home, and it said he was living with his grandmother, so he's not even living with his own mom. Now, where is there going to be the integrity that's going to make these children have a sense of responsibility to community and their loyalty to the infrastructure? It's totally broken. And I am sad when I see what's happening, but I also know that everyone for so many years, and you mentioned food stamps, and here we are again. Why do we have a proliferation of all these food stamps? It's because of the breakdown of the family. The more family breaks apart, less people are eating meals at home, less they're caring for each other, taking care of each other, and this is only a symptom. I'll tell you another symptom. There was a pastor who was out street preaching in Missouri, and he was arrested by the police. Now, if there's anybody who can help put the fabric back together, why are we taking a street preacher who is the one who has hope for bringing moral fiber to their community, and the police are now not only banning him from the street, but they confiscated his sound equipment, and then he got more sound equipment, and a few weeks later, they confiscated that. So that sends a loud and clear message. We don't want God. We don't want family. We're going to look the other way, put our hands over our ears, and sing a song pretending there's no such thing as family, and then we get surprised when stuff like this happens. I do want to touch on racism tonight because it's something we need to confront. And I'm going to say that same racism problem is a morality problem. And I don't know how anybody can ignore the obvious fact that when you have a bad attitude toward people because of their skin color, and then you try and make that the heart of this whole debate in Ferguson. Now, I write a newsletter every Tuesday, and if you'd like to get it, you can sign up for it on my website, which is cynthiadavis.net. And today I talked about what's going on in Ferguson because I wanted my listeners to come and hear you and be enlightened and be inspired. And what I said is this is a problem of our virtue missing. We've got missing virtue in Ferguson, and without the virtue, we're going to end up with fascism. Without people controlling themselves or having families control them, then we get heavy-handed government. Now, here's what's funny about it. I got some negative feedback. I love feedback. I don't really mind if it's positive or negative. But here's one reader who wrote me back. He said this: I think it's very naive to say that the Ferguson issue is not about racism, but it's about public relations. Family, friends, residents, and protesters are calling for justice and cannot help but see what they call injustice being perpetrated on the basis of race. Whether it's true or false, it is the core of their perception. One cannot dismiss race as being central to this whole debacle. No matter what the racial makeup of the Ferguson police force, it still is a white officer on a black teen involved in the deadly altercation. Like it or not, racial issues and race relations are at the center of this controversy. Now, I'd like to ask you to consider this question. If I had a car accident and the car that hit me happened to be a red car, and then the rest of my life, I'm always afraid of red cars because, after all, it was a red car that hit me. So therefore, everybody who drives a red car must be a mean, awful person. That would be wrong. And you would say to me, Cynthia, how could you be so silly? There are a lot of good people who drive red cars. How could you say such a thing? It's the person in the car. It's not the skin color. I am so offended that nobody is speaking out against this because racism happens everywhere. The more they're pushing the issue, the more they're proving how racist they all are. It's not your skin color that defines your behavior. It's racist to claim that your skin color defines your behavior. I guess my question is, how can we not understand that? How can we not be at a point anymore where we see it's what's in the heart, what's in the mind that is killing our community and our sense of belonging? I would open it up to any of you to address this, but help me with this.
I'm somebody who's at the darker end of the visible spectrum, or what in Canada is called a visible minority. And until recently, I thought I was Latino. It turns out I'm Hawaiian and Cherokee, but I'm a large brown guy. I'm often mistaken for black or Egyptian or Greek. I've never been mistaken for Swedish, but there are a number of other ethnicities that I've managed to say. The thing that I keep impressing upon people is that morality is not a matter of melanin content, and that there's one law that applies to everybody. It's the golden rule, or what's in libertarian circles called the non-aggression principle. What's happening now is that there are, of course, racial antagonisms that are being skillfully husbanded and exacerbated, because the people behind this want us to be looking with implacable suspicion at each other rather than examining what they're doing to all of us as they're consolidating power. And I'm desperately hoping that we've finally reached a point where people are going to be able to escape from that paradigm, that completely phony arrangement where we believe that God or nature or somebody has very conveniently color-coded the people we're supposed to worry about, and they're people that don't look like us. I did see some ground for encouragement last week when Al Sharpton was being heckled. Jesse Jackson in Ferguson has been mocked. These, of course, are people who have made a very healthy living for themselves as racial incendiaries and problem profiteers of that kind. I'm really hoping that what's going to come about as a result of this, one positive thing, would be to have people talk about the fact that human beings, as young people, need fathers in the home. They need intact families. people need to be obeying the golden rule in their conduct with each other, whether you're a teenager in a liquor store or whether you're a police officer on the street. And the people are going to start looking at suspicion with the people who are buying all these toys and give them to local law enforcement and arranging spectacles of the sort that we saw this last week. I'm hoping the people will start to escape these phony categories and these phony ghettos we've been assigned to.
And I would say, just real briefly, is that we've become a society of victims.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, and we need to blame somebody. When things go wrong or my expectations aren't met, it's got to be somebody else's fault. And that has been very carefully and crafted and created and manipulated, has been so aptly stated, for their own benefit. And the reality is we need to get back to the old basic principle that we are responsible for our own actions. We need to be held accountable. The world, we don't live in a perfect world. We need to accept when things go wrong. It's like, you know, in a game, when an official makes a bad call. You know, it happens. Get over it, move on, instead of making a big issue out of it. The reality is that's life. And we want fairness and we want justice. But that's not that we live in a fallen world. That's not always going to happen. And without a sense of God, and when you live in a humanistic, godless world where you don't have that resource of hope, of ultimate justice one day, you live a life of hopelessness. And when all this injustice piles up, that's where all of this is coming from. And I think even Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said the other day, it isn't racism. It's about economic inequality. And he's kind of right. This is complex. It's not just racism. It's moral. It's economic. It's political. It's social. And they're beginning to see that they have been left out deliberately and purposely. And so there is some antagonism about that. I saw an ISIS. It was an ISIS poster and an article. And one of the guys who were promoting ISIS in the crowd saying, what is democracy? Look what democracy's done to you guys. Do you see with this? That is playing on that. That's emphasizing the victimhood here. And we've got how we get beyond that is difficult because, you know, most research shows that once you reach 24, 25 years, your worldview is pretty well set. The vast majority of people aren't going to change that. So it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a challenge. But the reality is it's in God's hands. We need to be a voice like, you know, yeah, we all need to be Prophet Jeremiah. We need to speak the truth. We need to do what we can. But the outcome is in God's hands. It really is.
Well,
we can't change it, but God can. But we all need to be a voice for what we believe to be right and bring some light into the darkness.
And Dan, I'll add one more demographic group that was at the heart of this, and that is age. This young man was 18. Now, I blame the media for being irresponsible in the way they reported it, because as many times as they did, they referred to him as a black teen. And that's not part of the story. They didn't shoot him because he was black. Well, when they call him a teen, you know, as well as I do, when you turn 18, you're considered no longer a minor. So you're an adult. You'll be charged as an adult. And I had a talk. It's a biological fact that their frontal lobes, the frontal cortex in their brains, are not developed until they're 24, 25. I remember when I had an 18-year-old son, and I was frustrated by him and talked to a very mature friend who said, if you don't strangle them when they're 18, they come out to be pretty handy by the time they get a little older. But there's no question that kids do the darndest things. And so if somebody's not going to pay attention to get out of the street, you can understand why that would escalate things, especially if he had a guilty conscience. But let me tell you about my own son, because his skin is white. And he, at the age of 24, was treated pretty badly by the police officers. And I don't know why. It's not because, I guarantee you, it's not his skin color. But he asked a farmer if he could go fishing in his pond. The farmer said yes. And then he had the bad luck of fishing in the pond. The one day somebody stole some fertilizer from the farmer. So next thing my son knows, there are like four or five police cars behind him, and they wanted to rough him up. And they made him stand out in the pouring rain for an hour while they said, "We know you did it." What? And he's like, "Did what?" He was totally innocent. Yeah. But they know that it, and Dan, you can back me up on this. It's an interrogation technique that they can use when they're trying to pull information out of the suspect. They'll say, "We know what you did. Now you can confess it right now." And they pretend that you're such an awful person and we're going to get you in worse trouble yet unless you tell us what you did. And it's just ridiculous. And then for the next week after that, he was followed by the police every time he went to and from work. And I said to him, "Young man, I would be happy to go talk to the mayor of St. Peter's and tell them to knock it off because this is wrong." And he felt like, you know, he wanted to handle it himself. And I think in his heart, he was feeling like, "Mom, just because the other elected officials know who you are, I don't need to be treated differently." If this is what it feels like to be a youth or somebody who looks to be in that age bracket, then that's really sad. There are a few good ones. Unfortunately, I understand why they're trying to be aggressive, but that's unwarranted. Nevertheless, there's no excuse for the law enforcement being that rough with a citizen they're supposed to protect when they had not one shred of evidence except he was in a place where he could have potentially done an act of theft. But that's still no excuse for shoddy police work. So, Will, I mean, you've dealt with a lot of these stories, and Dan, you've probably seen a lot of it too. Thankfully, nothing awful happened, but you can't always control everything. What is your perspective?
I think the beginning of wisdom, as you and Dan both pointed out, is that you can't always control everything, and it's really sort of an idolatrous conceit to believe that you can. One of the things that you're describing in the mistreatment of your son here is a very common scenario, a very common situation where they're eager to clear a case and not to solve a crime. And unfortunately, the incentives aren't set up in law enforcement to where you'll have an emphasis on actually solving a crime rather than simply clearing cases. And that's maybe true in the case of Michael Brown. I mean, the extended video of the surveillance camera in that liquor store makes it appear that it may or may not have been the case that he was stealing the cigars. There might have been a misunderstanding about change. He might have been carded. It does appear that he assaulted a very much smaller person, but the case for robbery here is not quite as sound as it might be. And it's very much the case that Darren Wilson didn't know that Michael Brown may or may not have been involved in committing an act of strong-arm robbery. Nobody at the store, by the way, called 911. There's no victim statement here. The cigars have never been recovered. But if you read the police report, they say that the case was exceptionally cleared because the man who may or may not have stolen those cigars was shot dead in a subsequent confrontation that arose out of a jaywalking incident. The thing is, whether or not Michael Brown actually stole the cigars, there was no restitution made to the shopkeeper. And in a similar fashion, you've got these riots erupting and huge property damage being done. There's no proactive measures being taken by the people supposedly in charge of providing protection for property actually to protect those properties. And there's very low likelihood that these shopkeepers, these property owners, are ever going to receive restitution. And so one of the big and enduring complaints I have about the way the system operates right now is that if they identify a suspect altogether too often, this is not always the case, there are some conscientious police investigators, but altogether too often, they will seek, after finding a suspect, they will seek to fit the facts to the suspect rather than finding out what the facts would dictate as to who would be a plausible suspect. And most people in their encounters with the police don't understand that the police are not seeking to do you a favor when they're talking to you. They're not trying to clear you. They're trying to cage you. And they will exploit any opportunity to build a case around whatever you tell them. So don't talk to them beyond saying, I want an attorney. I want a lawyer. You know, whether or not you're somebody who believes that police are conscientious and dutiful and commendable, the fact is they're your adversaries in a situation of that kind. And then if you're an innocent person, then don't talk to them. And don't assume that your innocence is going to be something that's obvious to them. And don't assume that your innocence is going to matter to them either, because they're in the business of clearing cases. And that's something that I've tried to impress on my kids. My oldest is almost 17. He turned 17 in November. And I've explained to them, first of all, don't commit aggression against people's property. Don't steal. Don't hurt somebody. If you obey the golden rule, the two great commandments, you're not going to do something that would actually be a crime. But if you find yourself in a situation where a police officer is talking to you, don't. Just don't. You know, be polite, be cordial, be respectful. That's another human being. You know, they're, as human beings, entitled to that kind of deference. But do not assume that they mean you well. And unfortunately, it's gotten to the point now where we just don't have the luxury of believing that any of them mean us well, because once again, of the extent to which the government is trying to regulate everything we do and to criminalize everything we do, however innocuous. I like the fact that Dan made reference to Agenda 21 and some of these other grandiose social experiments. The only way that you can impose that type of society on people is if you make everybody presumptively a criminal. If you find some way of turning their innocuous everyday acts into violations of what we're told is the law, then we live in a situation of perpetual and irremediable insecurity, and we're completely dependent upon the grace of those who supposedly exercise divine power over us to do anything, anytime. And that's one of the reasons I think we're seeing this change in the law enforcement culture. They look upon us as criminals because the government is criminalizing everything we do.
They are.
Right. And it's creating an atmosphere of fear. The police are afraid. The people in the inner cities are afraid. Like the last night of the riots, a lot of crowds, it got a little contentious, but then there were two incidences where shots were fired and the crowd disappeared, you know, and in reality, it resolved itself because nobody wants to get hurt. And there is a real sense of fear. You know, and it's like, and the only way I can give you a comparison of that is my daughter, Sarah, she's a PA. She's 32 years old. She's single. She's been on the mission field. She worked for SIM in Sudan. She did take a job to build some money up as a contract worker for the U.S. government for the last year or so. And she's now running the embassy compound clinic in Baghdad. She's in charge of the Green Zone Clinic. And we've had conversation of the very crazy situation that is there and the very dangerous one. And what is really interesting is that she understands that what she's doing and where she's at is really pretty much in the center of the Lord's will. She really believes that where she's at now is where God wants her. And there is a real peace and understanding that she's not leaving this planet one day sooner, that if she's obedient to the Lord, she's not leaving this planet one day sooner than his good and perfect will is. And the reality is that she has total peace in all this chaos. She's confident that God is going to be, is going to do his good and perfect will in her life. And the day that the battle for Baghdad started a couple months ago, and this was before the military buildup happened, you know, we had a conversation that things were very precarious, that they may not get out. And the reality is that there was a great deal of peace that God was going to provide. And the reality is that the military has it's quite safe right now in the Green Zone. And the day we're having this conversation, it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon at her time when we were talking. And I said, Sarah, it's Saturday. Are you working today? She said, no, I'm going to the pool. So just total relaxed, total confidence, not concerned. And the reality is that when we have a people who don't know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, when you don't have that peace, that rock, that foundation to fall back on, when things go bad, fear steps in. You know, Scripture tells us that we haven't been given a spirit of fear, but of hope. And the reality is without that, when things go bad, we end up blaming, we end up becoming protective, we end up pointing fingers, we end up becoming self-serving. And it is, as our country has dissolved from a nation, as Patrick Henry said, this nation was founded on the gospel of Jesus Christ, to now where we have probably a vast majority of real, true, genuine, minority of real, true, genuine Christians. Can we not say, why is it surprising that our society has devolved? And I really think it is the real spiritual story of this, is that the real role, you know, the one thing that we can do to turn this around is to be witnesses to Jesus Christ, is to proclaim the gospel and because Jesus is the answer. We can throw out the UN, we can get rid of the Federal Reserve Act, we can dismantle this massive government, drop all the rules. But unless the nature of man's heart changes, we're just going to go down the same path again. In reality, it would be a cycle. So the real answer is Christ. The real answer is the gospel. The real hope is in the church and being a witness. And the big sad thing is that I really believe that a lot of Christians are terrified of persecution, terrified of people hating us, and we don't speak out about the real issues of life, let alone politics and economics. I think most of us are pretty quiet on that too, afraid to offend somebody, and which is the atmosphere they want, and we shut up, and I think that's the biggest problem.
Well, let me ask you this, Dan. You said, you don't have to talk to police officers, but I was talking to a police officer in O'Fallon the other night, and he told me that there are 150 hotel rooms that are booked for the incoming National Guard and all the buildup that they're having. And my community, I probably live between 20 and 25 miles from the epicenter. But do you think it was constitutional for the governor to call in the National Guard or even to bring in the State Highway Patrol and to declare Ferguson in a state of emergency? I mean, what do you believe is the right jurisdiction, and when should he have just left the locals to deal with it themselves?
Well, the reality is this really boils down to a state law, because these are state laws. Mm-hmm. And what does the Missouri Constitution say? McCulloch, the St. Louis County prosecutor, rightfully stated that the governor had no Missouri constitutional right to do this. And the reality is he doesn't. And so, which is kind of interesting, they had one night of martial law, where they declared a curfew, and then they dropped the curfew. But they really did have a curfew the next night, because come midnight last night, you had to leave. So this is all a big kabuki dance. Mm-hmm. You know, the ascent, you know, they put a face on it, they changed the wording, but in reality, it's still the same thing. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning, the imperative was, if you're going to protest during the day, don't do it at night. So here you have the government again telling you when, where, and how you can protest. And that's the solution. The solution is the government telling us more what we can do. And the reality is what do we have here? The government doesn't trust the people, and the people don't trust the government. And everything that was done here, and some of it was just bungled masterfully by people who didn't know what they were doing, and the higher ups love it, because this just makes it better for them. And we have people who can't lead, who don't know how to think through problems. They react out of fear, And so we go from one point of overreacting to the next night where we don't do anything. Even Jesse Jackson said, where were the police when these guys were looting these stores? Mm-hmm. And he's right. They just stood down, and police officers were across the street while the looting was going on. It's just insane. And the reality is what we're telling the world is we can't handle our own problems. We just need help from on high.
Well, Dan, why?
And that's being facilitated.
Why were the police standing down when stores were being
Because they
looted?
Were ordered to stand down.
Mm-hmm.
They were ordered to stand down. Do you understand? This is deliberate. This is purposeful. There isn't a balanced approach. This is being done on purpose. And the reality is you don't have leadership, moral leadership, who are simply there trying to appease both sides instead of simply doing the right thing.
Well, what were
and holding out a moral standard and challenging people to live up to that.
Okay, so the night they were told to stand down was the same night that my police officer friend told me they were going to do something like the movie Purge, where there was mayhem all night. They were expecting lawlessness. I don't get it. Who would have given the order to stand down? Are they not police officers?
Well, I can't answer that. I don't know. I know the captain from the Highway Patrol was in charge of the operation of all of that at that time. I can't say that he gave that order because I don't know that. But the reality is, obviously, the order was given. Who it came from, it could have even come from the governor. I don't know. Nobody knows. But the reality is that they went from overreaction to nothing. And when you do that, now you've ticked off everybody.
Mm-hmm.
In the overreaction, you ticked off the black community and the protesters, and then you don't react at all. And now you've irritated the businessmen, excuse me, the businessmen and the community leaders, and even like Jesse Jackson, basically says, where were the police? And he's right. Even a blind squirrel can find an acorn from time to time. But the reality is this was a horrible decision, and it was done out of fear. Instead of trying to do the right thing, they're trying to please men. They're trying to appease the crazies, and you can't do that. So the reality is there just isn't enough leadership, moral leadership with a good moral vision that people understand our Constitution and the principles that nation was built upon. They have no understanding of that. And the reality is so when you have these situations, if you have those principles, you'll be able to effectively deal with it and communicate that and get people on board. The key of leadership is communication. One thing I learned in the Marine Corps as an officer in the United States Marine Corps, the key to leadership is communication. I can communicate my vision. I can live it. I can amplify it. I'm an example of it. I'm not going to ask anybody to do that I wouldn't do myself. I can lead my team into the gates of hell and they'll follow me. And the reality is you can do that as government. You can do that as the police. You can do that at any level of government. And it's having a vision. It's having a right mindset and being able to communicate that. And what you saw here in Ferguson over the last couple of days is a total, utter failure of that completely. And out of that vacuum, guess what we're going to get? It's going to come down from on high. And this has been deliberately set up through our education system, through our training system. There's just people aren't prepared to deal with this. And that's what's unfortunate.
Well, we're fortunate that more people haven't gotten hurt or killed, because early in the process, I was talking to another police officer and I said, what is it going to take for it to stop? And he said, probably when people die. And that should give us all shudders, because that's not the goal here.
No. Listen to that mindset. Do you understand this? He doesn't get it. And that's the problem. And I would also like to say there's a spiritual aspect of this, too, because the other night they were anticipating that it was going to get very bad the other night.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I did mention, that every night this week in all the churches in the Ferguson, Florissant area have been packed, black and white, black churches, a lot of people going in asking for peace and asking for God to move and de-escalate this. And reality is, I think God moved last night. It got contentious at one point. I watched the thing as it went live the whole night. I was there till 1 o'clock in the morning watching all of this. And the reality is, I think God intervened. I think God showed some mercy and grace by the fact that for the people who, and God answered some prayers, and really the Lord de-escalated this, because this could have very, very closely come on down. In fact, I heard one report that because one group said, because the U.S. National Guard was there, that something was going to happen that night. And the news media reported that. And that apparently was the intelligence that the police had. They were really anticipating something major happen, and it didn't. So, I would have to say that God intervened last night for some mercy and grace and de-escalated this. And I praise God for that. And it has. And I would anticipate that it's probably going to calm down now. But the reality is when's the next incident? When's the next episode? Again, they took advantage of an unfortunate situation, and it'll happen again. And eventually, at one point somewhere, somehow, there's going to be that flash incident, and things will start to dissolve. And but where that is and when that is not. But the reality is it's just a lack of leadership. It's a lack of vision. It's a lack of knowing of who we have forgotten who we are as Americans. We have forgotten our culture. We've forgotten our heritage. We've forgotten our history. We don't know who we are anymore. And I think that's the problem.
That's good.
I can't improve on that.
I'm sorry I rambled a little bit too much.
No,
I apologize.
That's good. I attend a Bible study on Sunday nights, and I was with my Bible study group, and they raised the question, what should we do? Ferguson is in our backyard. It behooves us to do something, but what can we do? What is there? What is the proper response? Where do we belong in the whole scenario of being active, being salt, light, and actually making a difference? Do either of you gentlemen have an answer for me?
I can't really improve on what Dan has said, and at the risk of seeming somewhat peremptory and rude, I do need to go. I've got some family things I need to take care of here at this point. I've enjoyed the discussion. It's been a huge blessing to me, but I really do have to attend to a couple of really pressing family matters here. So with your permission, I'd like to leave, if that's all right.
Thank you for joining us, Will. It has been a true pleasure and delight, and I just want you to know how much we appreciate you, and if there's anything else we can do, or if you want to come on our show again, we'd love to have you.
I would enjoy that. Thank you so much. It's been very edifying for me. God bless you.
Thank you. You too.
God bless you too, Will. Thank you.
Goodbye. Okay, Dan, you are an amazing guest. Thank you for helping us wrap up. You put it back in perspective. If you were speaking to a group of people who wanted to be salt and light in the culture, what would your advice be?
It's real simple. Cynthia, the most important thing, I think, the message that the people on the street need to hear, and the people in any situation like this, where there is fear and there is a lack of hope, it is the gospel. The reality is, we can't depend on government. We can't depend on the economic system. We can't depend on these institutions. They're all failing. And unfortunately, what's coming on the other side of this isn't going to get much better. And the reality is, where's the hope? What is our only hope? And our hope is Christ. And it's not in this world and its systems, because the scripture says this world and its systems are passing away. And the reality is that that is the only message that really has an answer, because the system's broken. The police are broken. Our economy's broken. Our money's broken. Our government's broken. The Constitution is dead. It's been ignored. Great example, the Posse Comitatus Act, passed in 1887, has been ignored hundreds of times. And nobody says boo. The president has done things that he should be impeached. He never should have been president in the first place. And nobody does anything. Why? Because the system's broken. It really is. And neither side is able to or willing to do anything. So is there any hope there? And the answer is no. So where's my hope come from? Comes from Christ. Comes from the fact that I am just a sojourner here on earth, that I'm going to be dead a lot longer than I'm alive. And my only hope is in Christ and his salvation. And he's the one who's going to bring me peace and give me a vision and give me direction in my life through all of this chaos. Because if I don't, all I'm going to have is fear, insecurity, and end up playing the blame game and looking for somebody to blame and looking for, you know, my rights to be taken care of and at the expense of somebody else's rights. When the reality is if I come to Christ, I become a real servant. Think about it, Cynthia, if we had a whole culture and a whole society where everybody had a servant's heart, where everybody was looking out for other people, considering everyone better than themselves, we would never have any of these problems.
Right. Well,
when things go wrong, we wouldn't have these kinds of protests. We'd have people out there praying for the truth to come out and for justice to be done, wherever it led. And praying for both families, because the police officer's family's life is going to be disrupted horribly, as well as the victim is. And the reality is everyone suffers from this. And so that is our hope. There is no other solution. And as this world falls apart, as we see it around us, the hope is the gospel, that Jesus Christ died for us. We're all sinners. We all deserve judgment. And he took that judgment seat for us on the cross. And if we accept Jesus Christ and believe that what he's done for us, he's done for me and the sin in my life, that I can have not only eternal life, but a new heart, a Holy Spirit that can bring me peace and direction and hope beyond my circumstances, beyond this world, and know that I'm a child of God and that I am loved and accepted. And that is the real hope of this world. And that's the real answer. Beyond that, everything else is sand. The world is built on sand. And clearly, you know, you can't argue the fact it is all falling apart. I believe the Constitution was the best man-made document in the history of the world. And it's failing. And it has failed. And it's not the Constitution's fault. It's our fault. We have failed. And so what has not failed? Christ. What has been existing and eternal? His church. Who's coming again to rule the world? Jesus Christ. Who's coming again to rule with him? His church. So where should we want to be? Whose side do we want to be on? We want to be the side of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, because all other sides are going to be judged. All other things are falling away. All other things are passing away. And our only hope is Christ. That's the real answer. It's not in politics. It's not in economics. It's not in social and cultural racism issues. It's the gospel. It's our only hope.
Yep, that's good, Dan. In fact, I just to leave you on a happy note, I got an email from somebody who wrote this. Cynthia, you are exactly spot on. We cannot have a just government that is not first a moral government. Unfortunately, we are reaping what we sow. After 100-plus yep. years of neglect, we now wake up to find a nation that has turned its back on God. We are in a foot race to see if we can awaken enough citizens to correct that mistake before our once shining city on a hill is lost. Anyway, this person goes on to say, I would vote for Alan Keyes for president 1,000 times before I would consider John McCain.
Well, the problem is you'll never get a chance to vote for someone like Alan Keyes.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is the people that make it through the primaries are the people who've already been, who were globalists. And Reagan was a globalist. Bush was a globalist. Clinton was a globalist. Romney was a globalist. All of them are. You go back for the last 100 years. You don't make it to the top of the political heap unless you buy into the globalist agenda. It doesn't happen. There is no hope in the political system. It has been totally and completely bought off.
Well, Dan, you and I are doing our part by telling the story. At least I have a microphone. I've got a newsletter. I've got a way to communicate. You have your venue of communication also. And I believe that if we're faithful and diligent to do what we're called to do and what we're gifted to do, God will use whatever we have. We just lay out everything.
You're right, Cynthia. We be obedient to Christ. We need to be obedient to what he's called us to do. We need to be a voice. Whatever God has laid before us, we need to do those things. And the outcome is in God's hands.
Thank you, Dan. And will you be on our show again sometime?
Yeah, anytime you want to be back on, I'll be more than happy to talk.
It was great. The ultimate choice is it comes down to, are we going to have freedom and virtue, or are we going to have lawlessness and heavy-handed government? And I'm with you, Dan. Thank you for being a blessing, and I want to thank you for your time also. You've done a great job helping us.
Okay.
See you next time.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Cynthia.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.